is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The justice system is supposed to have multiple checks and balances, but like all human systems, mistakes are made. But those mistakes can have disastrous consequences for the individuals and the families of a person wrongfully convicted. Innocence projects across the country, usually operated out of law schools, have freed over 250 wrongfully convicted men and women. Since 2003, the Ohio Innocence Project at the University of Cincinnati has overturned 26 convictions. I am joined today by the Assistant Professor of Clinical Law at the University of Cincinnati College of Law, Jennifer Bergerson, and the 14th person exonerated out of the 26 by the UC Innocence Project, Roger Dean Gillespie, who was freed in late December 2011. To join our conversation, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome to Cincinnati Edition. It's good to have both of you here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Jennifer, let's start. Give us a sense of the scope of the Innocence Project, the Ohio Innocence Project. Now, how many cases approximately, I'm not looking for exact numbers, are you looking at right now at any one time and considering whether or not to take? How many cases or have you taken and are actually in process? What's sort of the dynamics here that are going on?
Well, we only accept cases from the state of Ohio. And since we were founded in 2003, we've looked at over 8,000 cases, and those are from inmates across the state who write into us asking for assistance. So at any given time, we have several hundred that are in a stage of investigation. That's handled primarily by our law student fellows. And then we usually have a dozen to 20 that are in active litigation at any given point in time.
So how many law students would be participating at any one time?
Usually it's about 20 who work with us for a year. Our new group is getting ready to start in a couple of weeks, and they work with us all summer full-time and then for credit during the school year.
I was wondering if, I mean, that means you have constant turnover.
We do.
Is that a problem on the cases?
It's a challenge for sure, but it's all part of the clinic model that we have to help the students learn. But it's also, we found, actually a benefit for the cases because it's very hard in these cases where the convictions are already done to figure out what to do next if there is something to do. And having a fresh set of eyes that can come in and review the evidence anew and kind of with a different take on it can be really helpful. So it actually helps us out a lot.
Dean, let's turn to your case. What were you originally accused and convicted of?
February 12th, 1991, I was convicted of armed robbery, kidnapping, and rape.
So those are pretty serious crimes.
Murder.
How did you end up getting convicted of those? You always maintain, as I understand it, you always maintained your innocence throughout the entire process. What is it that puts you at the center of that?
It all started with a vendetta from where I was working at General Motors. A guy didn't like me there.
So you think you know where it came from?
Oh, we definitely know beyond a reasonable doubt.
And so you're sent to prison, and did you try to find somebody to appeal and work the case right from the beginning?
Yeah, I was sentenced to 22 to 56 years in prison for crime I absolutely had nothing to do with. And, you know, after you go through the process, you're in shock of the whole thing of what happened, how did this happen, what went wrong, what, you know, I never knew people was in prison for something they didn't do. I never dreamed that happened. And then it happens to me, and you're sitting there trying to figure out how this went wrong. And my mother, who fought like crazy to get me out of prison, she stayed on.
What age were you?
I went in when I turned 25 in the county jail.
Okay.
So my mother fought, screamed and yelled and hollered at everybody who would listen until people quit listening. And there was an article in the paper that the University of Cincinnati was going to open an Innocence Project with Mark Gotze as the director. Mm-hmm. So her and her friend ran down to try to find Mark and ended up finding him. Fortunate for me, Channel 9 done a lot of reports on my case on how did this happen, why did it happen, you know, why are innocent people in prison type things. So it wasn't just a mother screaming and hollering about my son is innocent. She had other proof to back up that, you know, people were investigating. So I was actually the first case the Innocence Project took, the 14th person released out of the 26.
So the point is, once you took Dean's case, this went on for a long time. This is not quick turnaround.
Oh, no.
In terms.
Yours took, what, over 10 years for to finally?
It was 17 years.
Well, right.
After
I meant that we were.
Once they were involved.
Yep.
I think it looks, I thought it looked close to nine to me.
From 2002 to 2017.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. Well, there were still some things continuing after he was released. So
it wasn't totally
final quite yet.
Yeah, I was not totally exonerated until November of last year.
Oh, okay.
And then I was the 2076th person in the United States to be totally exonerated.
You've got those numbers down pretty
good.
Yes.
Well, actually, I wanted to throw into that. There is 2,200 and roughly 25 people who have been exonerated in the United States, served over 19,900 years.
And he's referencing there the National Registry of Exonerations.
Yes.
Right.
So our total at 26 is just a drop in the bucket. But also that's 492 years of wrongful incarceration with our 26 people.
And I think the point is that for any one person who's involved, those are all long years.
Absolutely.
If you're innocent. Jennifer, my understanding is, and I've read some things that were written at the time or different points during Dean's case, that Mark Godsey said at one point that the key thing was when it got kicked from the state courts into the federal court system, and said something to the effect that that's frequently the point where things can look a little bit differently. What's he mean by that?
Well, Dean's is a complicated case procedurally in that it ended up going through the state courts and the federal courts with a habeas case. I think what Mark was referencing there sort of more generally is the fact that it can be very hard when you go back into court to get someone to look at the case from a fresh perspective, because the way it's set up in the state of Ohio is if you take something back in post-conviction, it goes back to the same trial judge that tried the case. So if you're still dealing with the same judge, you're not always going to get a fresh look at it. And I think that's what ultimately helped Dean, was he had the federal courts looking at it from a new view of it.
Different perspective.
Right.
Fresh eyes.
Correct.
And nobody, I mean, if you're taking it back to the same judge who was the trial judge, they have interest in not admitting that something went wrong in their court too.
They never do that.
Let's be honest. So.
Well, that's what happened in Ruel Saylor's case, our newest exoneree that was just released a month and a half ago up in Cleveland, is it was the same judge who tried the case that was still on the case throughout. And there had been new trial motions filed even before we got involved, where the real shooter admitted he was the real shooter and explained who else was there and said that Ruel was not there. And, you know, that all fell on deaf ears.
Until what happened?
His case was unique because it actually went directly through the Conviction Integrity Unit out of Cleveland, which it's the only one in the state of Ohio. So we actually applied, and the prosecutor's office themselves did their own investigation of the case. And after over a year of actual investigation and talking to witnesses and looking into things again, they eventually came to the conclusion, which we had done years before, that Ruel was not involved in the case and had no role in it whatsoever. So they agreed that the conviction should be vacated.
Okay. That's an interesting twist. We have several callers who have called in. And I want to start with Jack. Jack, you have a question?
Yeah, I was listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's a piece about a case in Louisiana where someone was wrongfully convicted of murder, and they used the Brady Law, I believe it was, where the prosecution has to turn over evidence that could help the defense. Is any of your guests familiar with the Brady Law? Did they ever use that? Did they comment on it?
Well, yes, we are familiar with that. And that basically says that the state has to turn over any information to the defense before trial that could be helpful to the defendant. Yes, we do have several cases we've litigated where investigation has shown that there was information that was not turned over, including Dean's.
Yeah, my case was heavy Brady violations.
Okay, so it was related.
Very much police and prosecutorial.
Okay, so, and the we have a second caller who is, their question, their point is related to this. So I'm going to take this right now. So Drake, what's the point, observation, question you have?
First of all, I have a comment and then a question. The comment is, first of all, thanks so much for having this program, and thanks to the professor, and thanks to the gentleman that's on your show. I'm often amazed at how nice and how kind and how understandable these people who've been wrongfully convicted are. I would not be that way. You can't steal a person's life and then just expect it to go away. The question I have is for the professor, how possible is it, or plausible is it, that police officers who have either played with evidence, or prosecutors who've either withheld evidence, or judges has allowed some shenanigans to go in the courtroom that allows a wrongful conviction of a person, for those people to be prosecuted and serve the time that they have placed on an innocent person?
Well, the simple answer is that hardly ever happens where the police or the prosecutor, if they've done something wrong, are held accountable for any of their actions.
One time in American history, it happened. Michael Morton case out of Texas. Michael served 25 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. They proved the prosecutor had hidden evidence due to a lot of paper trails that he left. By the time that Michael was out and was doing his compensation suit, they found out the paper trail and the evidence of the prosecutor. By that time, he was a judge. He was sentenced to 10 days in jail and served 3. And that's the only case that I've known of yet that's happened.
Okay. So I want to be clear about this. The cases that you take, these are cases you believe that the person is, in fact, absolutely innocent, as opposed to simply a procedural issue in the trial, right?
That's correct. So when we take a Brady case, we will take it only if the evidence proves that they're actually innocent. We do get a lot of requests from people where there was some sort of procedural error, but they're still guilty. And so we do not take on those cases. So we do only take cases where we are convinced based on the evidence that the person is actually innocent. The only exception to that would be if there's someone who wants DNA testing, post-conviction DNA testing, and then that DNA testing would show conclusively one way or the other if they're innocent or guilty. And then if they want the testing and we think that it will show one way or the other, we will pursue those cases.
I want to pick up on a couple of things that have been said. One is the growth of DNA as a source of evidence. And, you know, it's used for lots of things out there, not just in courtrooms. How much has that changed the work that the Ohio Innocence Project has done? How often is that a major piece of what you're working with?
Well, we're actually seeing that it's a smaller piece of our litigation load now than it was, say, 10 years ago when I started doing this.
Really?
Yes. And the reason being is because when I started 10 years ago, we were still working through a lot of older cases from the state of Ohio that had been tried before DNA testing was around. There are still some where DNA testing didn't happen that we're looking into now. But there are a lot that we'll look into now where maybe there was some DNA testing, but we're looking at sort of the advancements in DNA testing that maybe if something couldn't have been figured out at the time of trial, we're looking at the new technologies now that could work. But as it's become more widespread, there a lot of the cases have already had some testing done at some point in time.
So it's not the magic silver bullet on every case as it would seem on television.
No, it's not. Unfortunately, I mean, there are a lot of cases where there just wasn't any DNA left behind. We would love if there were at every case because it would make our jobs a lot easier. But there's a lot of cases where there just wasn't any DNA. I mean, the good thing about all the DNA cases that have happened in Ohio and across the country is now people are understanding that wrongful convictions really do occur. And we've learned a lot about the causes behind those by looking back at all those cases where DNA exonerations happened and learning, you know, what things went wrong along the way.
Dean, and that last caller who called in, Drake, raised some interesting questions. And sort of one of those is it a crime for a prosecutor to withhold evidence? And if he's, you know, can he be prosecuted or she be prosecuted?
Actually, only in the state of California at this point right now. California just passed a law that.
So it's a recent law.
End of last year that a prosecutor can be. It's a felony.
It's a felony.
Yes.
So a serious crime with serious penalties attached. How often has it been applied so far?
Zero. I won't hold my breath on how long it will be either. Okay. I'd say it'll be a while.
A second thing that I think it was Drake who brought it up. He began by saying that he complimented you in your willingness to talk about this, said he wouldn't be so open. And how have you been able to put your life, I would say back together, but you were 25, you were really young. How have you been able to put your life together since the release in 2011? But maybe even more importantly, as it's been pointed out, there was still stuff hanging on until 2017.
Yeah. Actually, at 25 years old, I had bought my second home. I had purchased my third brand new vehicle. I was living it. You know, I was working at General Motors, and I had a plan. I was trying to be a millionaire by the time I was 38 years old, flipping houses before it was a fad and a thing. One of my dad's friends.
Why 38?
Just a number that came to me.
Okay. Yeah, all right.
It's just a number, and I thought that's when it's going to happen. And one of my dad's friends, that's what he'd done pretty much most of his adult life. And, you know, I seen that that's the way to go, and that's what I was doing. And it just, you know, then this happened. So, you know, now I'm 53 years old, and I live with my parents. You know, a lot of people think once you've been exonerated, you've been proven innocent, you're an instant millionaire. I've been out almost 7 years and still fighting to get one penny back. And my parents are buried in debt because of this. And, you know, the process after the exoneration, there's still a lot of collateral damage afterwards that has to be straightened out.
So, Jennifer, are there secondary suits for somebody who's been exonerated that they can then sue for compensation for a wrongful conviction? And if so, is that something your unit would deal with, or is that something another lawyer has to deal with?
Well, there is the possibility of getting compensation from the state of Ohio. There's a statute to that effect. And unfortunately, not all of our exonerees qualify under the statute for that. So only some of them have received compensation, and a lot of them have not. Regarding your question about whether we do that at the Ohio Innocence Project, no, we do not do those cases. Our mission is to assist those when they're wrongly convicted. And once they're out, there are private attorneys that will assist them with that.
Okay. It becomes, well, a civil suit where
right.
the attorney would get paid if they win type of thing.
Correct.
So given that you're not an instant millionaire, you're now living with your parents. So how would you describe the rest of your life?
Absolutely magnificent. Me and my dad go fishing all the time. And, you know, we call home and say, what's for supper? Mom's cooking something. How can you beat that? I call myself a senior daycare provider right now. So I keep them moving around and doing things and having fun. You know, I travel all over the world. I've been all over the world speaking about wrongful incarcerations with the Ohio Innocence Project. Last year, me and my girlfriend got to go to Italy. We got to go to Ireland. 25,000 miles last year speaking about wrongful incarceration.
Okay, so this is something that's become a cause for you.
Absolutely. And the caller before, you said, you know, he wouldn't be. The reason is you have to get the word out. to keep this from happening to someone else. That's why I do it. That's why I try to stay positive. That's why I scream and yell about this subject.
Mm-hmm. The fact that not just for you, Dean, but for others who have been exonerated, the fact that the internet exists and that if you've got a conviction, even if you've been exonerated, there's going to be all kinds of stuff out there. How does that impact your life?
For me, you know, with the situation that I was in, a year after I was out, the prosecutor was so angry that I was living life and having a good time. He called my lawyer and said, hey, your guy didn't register as a sex offender. He's not registered as a sex offender on registry. And because of that, we're going to lock him back up unless he registers. So I had to go register. This is under appeal. This is an area in the law that's very gray area in the law. And I was exonerated, but it was under appeal. So you got that going on the internet. That's a big deal in people's minds in America. It's a insignificant list. People don't ever really look at or anything like that, but it's one of those things that's on the internet. And I can assure you, you can punch my name in somewhere. It's still there as being a sex offender.
And do people that you run into, even though you've been exonerated, do people assume or say or indicate they think, well, you're still guilty?
I've never personally ran into any of that. You know, I was with three of my friends in Kentucky when this supposedly happened. When I got out, 600 people come to my house to visit me. That's the support I had. Very rare to have that kind of support. So I've never experienced it. I'm sure it does happen. But for me personally, it's never happened. This case was so absurd to start with. Just 10 minutes of reading it, you can see, well, what in the world?
Jennifer, what would you say about other people that you've observed who have been exonerated, their ability to sort of put pieces back together or together for the first time or however you want to put that? What's the recovery process and is it – what happens there?
Well, of course, it's different for everybody, right. Somewhat, but I would say that I think the majority of those coming out of prison have some sort of PTSD just from the experience that they have been through. And then a lot of it depends on the family and other support that they have available. You know, even if they do receive compensation from the state, nobody ever receives it right when they come out. So, you know, they literally come out of the prison with the clothes they're wearing and that's it. No cash, no extra clothing, no toothbrush. So it's a challenge for sure for all of them. But, you know, the majority of our exonerees, I'm happy to say, have done incredibly well. And a lot of them are like Dean. They're just incredibly...
resilient.
Yeah, thank you. Great word. Resilient and not bitter and angry. And I'm always amazed by that because I feel bitter and angry sometimes after working on their cases. And sometimes if we have a loss in a case, our clients will be the ones that are lifting us up for the next step.
Wow.
Yeah, if you look at one of our cases, Ricky Jackson, we had the longest serving innocent man in American history for a while, 39 years in prison. And when he was exonerated, he was basically kicked out the prison, and there you go, on the street. You know, fortunately, we were able to put him up in a hotel for a few weeks and find him a place to live. Otherwise, he'd have been walking the street in the clothes they gave him.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being here today. I want to thank both of you for the work that you're doing and for the attitude that you bring to this. I think that speaks volumes. And good luck on the future cases.
Thank you.
And bring these back to us. This is a powerful story, not just Dean's story, but the whole story of the Ohio Innocence Project. So thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.